tự mình bán chiếc xe của mình. Ngoài ra, việc tặng xe của bạn được khấu trừ thuế. Hãy truy cập kfai.org để bắt đầu. Chúng tôi sẽ bán xe của bạn và số tiền thu được sẽ hỗ trợ cho trạm này bắt đầu từ hôm nay.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
Magandang gabi sa inyong lahat, and welcome to the Filipino American National News. I'm Alan Banju. Not only is it Filipino American History Month, but it is the annual fall membership pledge drive here at KFAI. And if you're looking to support the Filipino American National News, along with all the great variety of shows here on KFAI, you can do so in a few ways. You can do so by calling our phone lines at 612-375-9030, or you can also do it online via kfai.org. Just a reminder to our listeners as well, we are running part three of our interview with Filipino American wrestler TJ Perkins. We go into his love of ink, aka tattoo, some of his experiences with sports, his love for hockey, along with his fandom for Kobe Bryant and the Lakers, along with some future projects that he does have on the horizon. But as we said, it is Fall Pledge Drive here at KFAI, and you can do so in one of two ways, 612-375-9030. If you're new to the Filipino American National News, it is the longest running weekly Filipino radio program in the United States. We have been lucky through the years to interview many great people from many different walks of life, whether they be community leaders here within Minnesota, where we are based, or speaking with celebrities or athletes, or even gurus of martial arts. Some of the recent interviews that we've been able to have here on the Filipino American National News, as you're listening, you'll be hearing part three of our interview with Filipino-American wrestler T.J. Perkins. And then in the future, very near future, we'll be putting that on all our social media platforms, the full hour-plus interview with Mr. T.J. Perkins. But this past summer, we've been able to interview the likes of Ellie Mack. But for those of you that aren't familiar with the name Ellie Mack, she was first getting her notoriety 20 years ago on American Idol with her given name Camille Velasco. We spoke with martial arts gurus, and we had the great Daniel Anasanto, who was in town this past spring for a workshop to talk about the Filipina martial arts of Eskrima Arenes and his relationship with the late, great Bruce Lee. We've also had the privilege of interviewing NBA head coach Eric Spoelstra of the Miami Heat on the Filipino American National News, along with interviewing the likes of Houston Rockets phenom Filipino American Jalen Green. But we also have talked to stars of the hockey world. We've talked in the past with now former Minnesota Wild, now currently Arizona Coyote defenseman Matt Dumba, who has always been gracious to us here on the Filipino American National News. And we've been able to talk to the Robertson brothers, Nick and Jason. Nick Robertson of the Toronto Maple Leafs and Jason Robertson of the Dallas Stars. And Jason Robertson, some of the fastest rising stars in the NHL, one of the top leading scorers last year and an all-star in the all-star game. But like we said, it is pledge drive here at KFAI and the Filipino American National News. And if you are looking to make a pledge, feel free to do so, because we got those phone operators ready to answer those phone calls at 612-375-9030. Or you can also do it online at kfai.org/Filipino American National News. And as we stated before, is the longest running Filipino radio program in the United States. But for right now, we're going to play the final chapter of our visit with Filipino American wrestler TJ Perkins. So I hope you enjoy this final part of the interview.
The Filipino American National News is proud to have on the show tonight Filipino American wrestler TJ Perkins. Welcome to the show, TJ.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
You know, the one thing they say about Filipinos is that we tend to not age, at least in the face, for quite a while. And it's almost hard to believe that you've been wrestling approximately about 25 years and you're not even 40 yet.
Yeah, I believe 25 years was just a few weeks ago, August. So, and yeah, I just turned 39, so I'm close, but I am in an odd sweet spot where I think somebody asked me on Twitter the other day, or no, I'm sorry, it was like a rhetorical question about like what modern wrestler under 40 would make a great NWO member from the 90s. And I said, I don't think I'd make a good NWO member, but it made me think about how it's kind of crazy. I'm not yet 40, but I could have been in the actual NWO if timing would have worked out. But.
And you've had a love for wrestling at a very young age. What sparked your interest in professional wrestling?
It came naturally to me. I don't know, you know, I mean, why does a kid like Spider-Man, right? It was the first, my earliest memories are of kind of watching it with my dad, Saturday night's main event, like that era. You know, Randy Savage with the giant poncho cape and Hulkamania at its peak, you know, around that time, you know, we're talking probably 1986 or so. Like, yeah, my earliest memories of being, you know, 2 or 3 years old, just like a toddler, is just watching it with him, and I just been hooked ever since.
And why did you think that wrestling was the sport for you to go into at such an early age?
You know, I didn't really plan, I guess, on being in it at the age that I did. That just sort of happened that way. It's hard to say. It's such a weird thing to say, like, maybe it's over romanticizing it a little bit, but in a weird way, I feel like it chose me. I don't know how I ended up doing it at the age that I did. It just somewhere between you get old enough to start doing career day at school and you know, every kid's first career day, they always do something that gets corrected by the teacher, like that's not realistic. And then the next year they start doing better at the career day projects. They pick, you know, whatever they pick, dental assistant, plumber, whatever the case is, right? But you know, when I picked a pro athlete and, you know, pro wrestler in the beginning, you know, you get those answers. And for me, I felt like it's not good enough. You know, like you're telling me no, but it's like all these other things you want me to aspire to do is just as hard. Like, you know how hard it would be to be an astronaut? You know, that's insane. Like my sister became a doctor, very Filipino of her. and I just think about like her path, and it's like, if I, you know, a more acceptable career day project for them would have been for me to say like doctor. And it's like, I couldn't imagine how hard it would be for me to accomplish that. But it felt like this, I didn't know how I was going to get started, but it was within reach somehow, you know? And the irony is, you know, when you do these projects, you're, you know, about 11, 12 years old. And it was only like a year later at 13 that I started doing it. So I feel like it sort of found me at the time that I was clearly telling my world around me, like, I'm ready to do this. You can't tell me no. I just, you know, I'm trying to do it responsibly, but we'll see what happens.
And I've often heard you say about the beginning of your journey. Back then, there isn't Google, there isn't the internet to refer to, and you wrote letters to many wrestling schools trying to get your start. I mean, you had to be really devoted, even at a young age, to go that path and write those letters.
Yeah, it was, when I was in Mexico recently on a trip, and one of my teammates there, he's a younger member of New Japan Pro Wrestling, Kevin Knight. He's, I don't know how old he is. He might be in his mid-20s, I want to say. And he was asking me and Rocky Romero, like, about that generation, like, what it was like. And I tried to give him two kind of examples, like, stories that I could tell to kind of demonstrate what it was like. But, yeah, in a nutshell, it kind of blew his mind to think about a world where it's like Google doesn't, it's not just social media, you know, like, so we're talking obviously Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, all these things, they don't exist, but like the Google search engine did not exist, you know, MySpace and Facebook did not exist. YouTube did not exist. MapQuest did not exist yet. So you still had to ask somebody, you know, with the address, you had to kind of ask a local, like, how to get there. And they would tell you, like, well, here's some cross streets and it's nearby this thing. And here's a landmark to, you know, you're close when you're nearby this hospital or whatever. And you would just kind of, like, if you had to drive out of town, you just had to, like, you had to drive from LA to San Francisco just generally. And then once you got close, once you knew you were in town, you had to pull over at gas stations and say, you know, I'm looking for this place. And you'd have like the Thomas guide, we called it, on the map and stuff. And you had to write directions down on a napkin. Most people didn't have cell phones yet either. So like, you know, if you had to communicate, you had to pull over and put a quarter in a payphone and call and ask somebody, hey, I'm close. So, you know, just getting to work was actually an adventure in and of itself. Like, work was actually the easy part.
Yeah, the current generation of people that didn't grow up in that time, they really don't know what an atlas is and how you use that to get around for directions. Yeah. And how big those could be.
Yeah,
at that time.
I remember having, you know, states, each book was like, would have like the whole state. So you had this big, like, book that was just California's maps, you know, if I was doing only California stuff, and then branching out from LA to Las Vegas or say Arizona, things like that, crossing state lines, then it started to get really, difficult. You know, you almost had to be part of a caravan so you knew everybody was going together. So
with you starting wrestling at such a young age, you weren't driving. If you were booked in one town and say the next town is, say it is San Bernardino, but the next town is Portland, that oftentimes you had to hitch rides with other people. Yeah. And the amount of trust you had to have with your other fellow wrestlers or whatever means you took to do that. I think you said that oftentimes you would go to school at the beginning of the day on a Friday and then leave midday to embark on these wrestling excursions. I mean,
yeah,
pretty ballsy there, TJ.
Yeah, that was another thing Rocky was trying to tell Kevin, is that how kind of crazy I was, I guess, in retrospect. At the time, you don't think about it, you know. I kind of feel like in retrospect, in a nutshell, it's kind of like it would be easier to kind of assess it like I was like a circus runaway, you know. Like I think it was a Jackie Chan. I think he kind of like as an adolescent kind of joined the Chinese circus or something. That's how he sort of got his upbringing as a performer. I mean, it's kind of like that, you know, like, and at the time, you know, you don't think it's a big deal, and people will understand this the older they get, I guess. And maybe this means that I'm getting old, but you know, generationally things change and the relativity changes and things don't, you know, you start to realize that life was never really that surprising. You kind of look at it in retrospect. On paper, it looks wild, you know, but mm-hmm. at that time, you know, we grew up at a time where, not that we generally had a better sense of trust in people or that like we dismissed the fear of the unknown, but it was almost like we came up at a time, at that time, where the world was, I don't think we accept anymore that the world is a jungle. At the time we did. So at that time, it's kind of like, it wasn't surprising that some of the stuff was maybe a little bit, I don't know if danger is the right word, but like a little risky, but it's like, we accepted it because it's like, well, you know, this is not like, oh, this is just how it is. But in a way that sort of is the mindset. That's just how it was. So you just kind of knew. And so like when I would, you know, I had a pretty immediate trust in people in the sense of, you know, you knew them a little bit, you shared a space with them. And if they were any other person in the world, how much trust would you have in anybody? You got to make your way, right? So luckily for me, I survived, but I did the best I could. But yeah, you know, you'd ditch school on a Friday morning and jump in a car and you'd go to, I don't know, San Diego or something like that. And then, you know, the next day in the locker room, you'd ask people like, hey, who's on the show in Tijuana tomorrow? And like some guys would say, hey, like, let me jump in with you and we'll go to that show. And then you'd be in Mexico at that show. And if there's Americans in the locker room or whatever, like who's on the show in Anaheim, you know, Sunday or in San Francisco, and somebody would raise their hand, you jump in that car and you go up there and then you just ask, hey, is there anybody that's coming back to Southern California and then go back to school on Monday? And that was usually how my week would go.
And just a reminder to our listeners, we have Filipino American wrestler TJ Perkins on the show. You've had a long history with a New Japan Pro Wrestling. And from what I know of your early starts, New Japan was opening a dojo in the LA area. And I believe from what I've heard that first initial class that you were with had Samoa Joe, Rocky Romero, who you spoke of, and Ricky Reyes, and somewhere down the line, Bryan Danielson. What was that experience like with all you guys at that young age? I know you were definitely the youngest of that group, but what was like that experience for you?
I mean, it changed my life and career, obviously. I mean, that's really kind of the first big break I had. It stemmed from, there was a developmental territory for WWF at the time. They were still WWF. It was called UPW and it was in Los Angeles. And so for anybody that's familiar with modern wrestling, and the equivalent would be like if WWE had NXT, but it was based in LA at the time. And that's where John Cena came from, The Miz, I think, to an extent. I think he was already trained a little bit when he got there. Victoria, former WWE diva Victoria, and a few others. And so I was in that when I was like 15, 14, 15 years old, something like that. So it'd be like if you're a 15-year-old kid at NXT right now. And then imagine if NXT closed down and WWE opened up a new development place somewhere else. So that's essentially what happened is UPW and WWE parted ways, but UPW immediately linked up with a Japanese company called Zero One, which had just started. And for wrestling, I guess, historians, they basically started as guys that left New Japan Pro Wrestling and decided to open a new company. And in the process of them becoming a development company for Zero One, I kind of just like, I didn't make the cut essentially. Like they had guys that they were trying to send to WWE. So when they switched over, they sent them to Zero One and I was in the back of that line, so to speak. And so was, you know, Ricky Reyes, Rocky Romero. Samoa Joe was in Zero One. So that is why he never ended up going to New Japan. However, New Japan, who the Inoki family was still a prominent figurehead. The Inoki family is like the McMahon family for New Japan Pro Wrestling, is the best equivalent I could put it. Antonio Inoki is like Vince McMahon, if Vince McMahon was an actual wrestler. So Antonio Inoki lived in Santa Monica, and he wanted to open up an extension of New Japan in LA, and they opened it there. And they were closely associated with UPW in that office and Zero One. They had peaceful negotiations, so to speak, in a way. And so they said, well, we need to scout some of your guys. And we happened to be the first group. Samoa Joe wanted to go, but he was very dedicated to Zero One, so he never appeared. Danielson came almost immediately. He was pretty much shortly right after us. But yeah, I mean, we were there ever since the mats were rolled out and the bags were hung on the hooks and the ring was put up, and yeah, the rest is history. I did that. That was my senior year of high school that they scouted me. So I was like the New Japan equivalent of, I guess, Nick Wayne.
And eventually you did make your way to Japan. For our listening audience that isn't familiar with the term, back then, and I guess they probably still use this term now, but you were considered a young boy. What is a young boy in terms of Japanese wrestling?
So being the youngest out of that group, you know, Rocky Romero's the closest to me. He's like 2 years older than me, but like Danielson's, you know, a few years older. Ricky Reyes is a few years older. So they were considered more to just come in as regular performers. Because I was so young, I was only 17, they saw that it was an opportunity for, like you said, for me to be a young boy, different than them because of my age. And a young boy is essentially like a private in the army, you know, like you come in at the lowest rank. And for me, it would be like if I was already a soldier in a different army and they said, hey, would you come into this army, put on the old fatigue, shave your head and start from square one, but we're going to take care of you. We'll give you a good life. And I said, yeah. So I had to sort of swallow my pride a little bit, you know, like to put it in perspective, like I had already been wrestling as long as like Rocky Romero, Ricky Reyes, and I think a little bit longer than Samoa Joe and longer than Danielson, but I was willing to say, okay, my age is something you guys value, so I'll start over if you want. And, you know, famous young boys in history. Chris Benoit was a famous young boy in history. My class in particular from Japan included Nakamura from WWE was in my class. Yoshitatsu, who was also in WWE for a little bit. And in New Japan currently, Taguchi and Haruki Goto, they're two, you know, veteran performers in New Japan. They were in my class. And so we all started together. I was the class right behind Shibata and Tanahashi and Yano. So you could kind of like get a gauge on how long ago this was. Tanahashi was barely graduated when I came along. And yeah, you just, it's like being a private in the army. You start over with basic training all over again. They build you, they rebuild you in a sense from the ground up. And then you graduate into what they want you to be. And I was willing to do that.
The funny thing I like in hearing stories about your experience in Japan is some of the wrestlers that you've admired, Benoit, Jericho, they had interesting names in Japan.
Yeah.
Jericho being Lionheart. But they gave you kind of the most obvious name they could give you, and they called you Pinoy Boy.
Yeah, that was actually a nickname that I had in high school. My best friend was Filipino. His name is also Alan, by the way. We used to say Pinoy Boy back and forth. And when I first started wrestling, before New Japan ever scouted me, I needed some sort of like nickname or moniker, you know, when I was just wrestling locally in Los Angeles and Mexico and things like that. So I chose Pinoy Boy as my nickname. And it was always a goal of mine. It was always important for me to sort of represent the flag and the culture, you know. Not so much the flag for like nationality purposes. Obviously, I was born in America, but I was the first in my mom's family to be born in America. So it was really important more for the culture of it, you know, just because it's so recognizable anywhere you are in the world, the sun and the three stars and the colors and everything. So yeah, I chose Pinoy Boy as my nickname. And when I went to New Japan, they said, you know what, this is fine. You can still keep that name. Eventually they bestowed upon me a totally different character, which grew me up a little bit more.
From Japan, you made your way into Mexico. Mexico is known for the Lucha Libre style. How was that experience for you in Mexico?
Mexico was great. It's my favorite wrestling culture in the world, in my opinion. It's timeless. It's very classic. I think it's very misunderstood by Americans, like North Americans and Europeans. They look at Mexico as something that's very, like, they're very physically gifted and the acrobatics and athleticism involved. But in all honesty, I think they're the best performers in the world. You really learn how to be a good performer and to be a good character there, to be a good professional. Like, you learn how to carry yourself. And it's really one of the, like I said, it's kind of a time warp. It's one of the only places in the world where it's an every night job there still. Like, everywhere else in the world, that's kind of like gone away. Like, Japan is still a touring system. It's an every night job. You know, America, only if you're in the major leagues is it an every night job, like in WWE, that, or, you know, that sort of setting. But like in Europe, like, that's been gone for generations now. And in America, outside of the major companies, it's not like the territories were. And in Mexico, you wrestle every single day and you really get really good at your craft when you're down there. And that's really what I learned at that time, being a teenager down there and working in that environment. Like, I learned how to be a real professional down there. And every time I go back, it's a very fresh reminder of what it means to be an everyday professional in this business, I think.
The great thing about the TJ Perkins story is that you tend to not be complacent in one place. I think you're obviously a wrestling historian and your skill set is quite diverse. Do you think because of that diverse skill set, it helped you get different opportunities in different wrestling promotions?
I do. I don't know how many like wrestling industry people are watching this in particular, but if there are, a way to answer this question, I guess, would be I've worked everywhere. I've worked in every office that there is up until recently. The only one was AEW that I hadn't been to, but after Forbidden Door, now I've got an idea. I've never been anywhere out of all these places, you know, everywhere in the world. I've never, ever had a job where I had to sit down and speak about a match rating quality or something like that, or every single thing revolves around, you know, where you've been, what you can do.